from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The latest news out of the German Wings air disaster in the French Alps. The co-pilot who apparently crashed the jet was treated in the past for suicidal tendencies. Okay, maybe that's surmountable, but it wasn't surmounted in this case. 150 people are dead. Flyers want a fail-safe. Is there one? This hour on Point, we look at pilots, pilot mental health, airline procedures, and the plane crash in the French Alps. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What more can be done, should be done, to protect airline passengers, to protect pilots, even from themselves? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Berlin in Germany, Jivan Vasiger, Berlin correspondent for the Financial Times. Jivan, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
What is the latest here on the reports of treatment for suicidal tendencies some years ago, I guess, on Andreas Lubitz's part?
That's right. Well, as we've just heard from the Dusseldorf state prosecutor, Lubitz received extensive therapeutic treatment for suicidal tendencies. Now, this was some years ago. The prosecutor is saying this happened before he received his pilot license. He did receive treatment subsequently, but they said when he was receiving this subsequent treatment, he wasn't assessed on the subsequent occasions as being suicidal. So this was all, they say, sometime in the past.
We know, we were told, Jivan, that he took a break from his pilot training at one point. Do we know if that is the period during which he had this treatment?
That's right. Well, we haven't quite fitted this together, but that's the assumption that everyone's making at the moment. We're trying to verify this information with Lufthansa. It does appear to match up to the dates we have. So during his pilot training about 6 years ago, they say that he took a break of several months, and this does seem to overlap with what the prosecutor is talking about today.
What other new details are coming out as we go here? We're hearing more about the captain of the flight, the main pilot trying to break the door down with something metallic, possibly even an axe. What's known on that front in that final descent?
That's right. I mean, these are details from the voice recorder, and we believe that in the sort of final kind of desperate moments, it sounds as if the captain was trying to batter the door down with an axe. And the reports that we have out of this suggest that, you know, as the captain became increasingly desperate, he was trying to break his way in. The passengers realized what was going on and were screaming in horror, as anyone would be in this situation. So the last of dreadful moments of this flight have come to light.
What is there anything else that's been learned about Andreas Lubitz's personal background, his life in the days, months, years leading up to this terrible mass death that might illuminate what happened?
Well, there are reports. I mean, a lot of these reports are very speculative, suggesting that he had sort of various kind of sort of on-off relationships with his girlfriends, that there was an ex-girlfriend who talked to the Bild newspaper in Germany about him wanting to carry out some kind of spectacular act, and we're not sure what that was a reference to, really.
Something about he said he would be famous and he would change the way the world worked.
That's right. And this is very much, I should say, we're hearing this secondhand. This was reported by one of the big sort of tabloid newspapers here in Germany. But yeah, claims that he was perhaps an unreliable character, a fantasist. And obviously, there's been a lot of speculation about his mental state. I mean, it adds up to suggest that this was an individual who perhaps really shouldn't have been at the helm of a plane.
His eyesight also has become an issue of speculation. Was there a problem there that's confirmed?
Well, there has been a question about his eyesight, and it's not been clear whether this was a physical problem or something psychosomatic. Now, the prosecutor said today that there was no organic disease, so this suggests that if there was a problem with his eyesight, it might have been psychosomatic, because it has been suggested that he feared that he was losing his vision, would therefore be unable to fly, and that might have been a trigger for this act. But the prosecutor today appearing to rule out any kind of organic illness.
The head of Lufthansa, the parent company of German Wings, has said in the last week that Lubitz passed all of his physical and mental exams with flying colors. Is there any standing down on that assertion?
Well, The thing to point out here is that the recent assessments of Lubitz's health, I mean, the pilot assessments that Lufthansa would have been aware of, they were physical checks of his health. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't have found anything wrong with him. And Lubitz, I mean, the problem here is that Lubitz was hiding his mental health problems. I mean, we've heard from the prosecutor that he had these sick notes at home. The doctor had written him, given him leave of absence from work, but they were ripped up and found at his home. So Lufthansa, it seems, didn't know just what was wrong with their co-pilot.
And is it clear that those notes giving him, saying give him time off if he needs it, that those were about his mental health?
They do appear to be about his mental health, I think, once we've excluded any physical problem, which the prosecutor has done today.
Apart from these potentially sort of grandiose statements to a girlfriend, is there anything else that's emerged in his record which would explain to the public mind why he would have taken so many people with him if his own death was his primary goal?
Well, very little explanation, really. I mean, it does appear to be clear from speaking to people who knew him when he was a boy that he absolutely loved flying. That was a sort of central mm-hmm. part of his life. And if he might have had the fear that it would be taken away from him, he might perhaps have been inspired to some extreme act. And it might be, I mean, the speculation is that he feared he was losing his sight, and that therefore that's something that might have impelled him to such a dramatic act. But we now know that, you know, he wasn't losing his sight. It was all in his mind. And that seems to be where the center of the mystery is here.
Policy changes in German air flight at this point. The United States already requires two to be in the cockpit, not necessarily a pilot, but at least a flight attendant. If one pilot leaves, what about Europe now?
Well, there's certainly no magical solution to the problem of pilot suicide, as we know. I mean, if we hark back to the Egyptair crash in 1999, there were two pilots in the cockpit at that time, and that was thought to be a pilot suicide where the captain wasn't able to prevent his co-pilot bringing the plane down. Now, rules are changing in Europe. It has been the case, as you pointed out, that in Europe a pilot is allowed to be in the cockpit on his own. That's now shifting. Lufthansa hasn't come out on this, but other airlines have. And there's also debate going on about the need to know more about a pilot's medical conditions and need to know more about a pilot's mental health. That's obviously a very, very sensitive point of debate.
Jivan, you're a journalist on the ground there in Berlin. Do you have the sense that we're getting, A, the accurate story, and B, something like the full story beginning to emerge here?
Well, I think that's very difficult to establish because we're obviously talking about something that was on the inside of one individual's mind. It's a very, very difficult matter to investigate. And Lubitz was, of course, concealing this from his own employers. So we have very little way of knowing exactly what was going on there. I think that the facts are slowly beginning to come out, but there's a lot more to be known about him, and there are many things that may never be known about this man.
Jivan Vasagar with us from Berlin, correspondent there for the Financial Times. Jivan, thank you very much for spending a minute with us today.
Most welcome.
We'll hear in a moment from a couple of aviation experts on the, looking right across the industry and particularly at the psychology side of piloting passenger airliners. But first, joining me from Königswinter, Germany, is Andrew Dennison, director of the Transatlantic Networks. It's a research consortium based there. He's a former professor of political science at the University of Bonn. Andrew Dennison, thank you very much for being with us.
You bet, Tom.
We have seen the grief, and who wouldn't understand it? A lot of students on that flight, a lot of loved ones on that flight, of many nationalities, Germans above all. How is Germany, how are Germans taking on board what has happened here, Andrew?
Shock. First of all, at the loss, when, you know, something happens as common as flying from Dusseldorf to Barcelona and ends with tragic consequences like this, then people are shocked because they can identify with it very easily. We all do it now. The school class was a particular group that really evoked the tragic nature of this event. People could relate. I myself have teenagers, talk to my teenagers that go to school here about what happened. It's a tragedy, and Germany is concerned about its self-image and things like that, but Europe shared in this tragedy. We saw Angela Merkel, French President Hollande, and the Spanish president, Reyes, standing there together. And the Europeans, because they fly back and forth from Dusseldorf to Barcelona so easily these days, do share in their sorrow. So, yeah, Germans have been shocked, especially that an individual would do something like that. They have shared their sorrow with other Europeans, though.
Germans take pride in their processes and their precision. Is this a particular kind of insult to German self-image that this would happen?
It is, Tom. Germans don't take failure lightly. You know, we have an image of Germans, thorough, strict, proud. And so when their systems work so that the head of Lufthansa, Carsten Spohr, can say he was 100% flight fit, and at the same time, reality, of course, speaking the opposite fact, that this man was not, even though the system apparently worked. That's upsetting for Germans, and I think also, you know, Germans, it's an anxious time now. Certain things that were taken for granted, the success of the euro, or that Russia wasn't sent tanks across the Ukrainian border, you know, those have been proven untrue. And now this notion that's also, you know, a brand, it's a logo for Germany, German security, German competence, that's been called into question, both the psychology of the pilot and the systems designed to vet them out. So it's unsettling for Germany.
They're making process changes here. I understand Germany now also will require two in the cockpit at all times.
Yeah, and you know, from catastrophes, you should learn. And so, yes, Tom, they are now doing that. At the same time, there's an underlying sense of shame that rule was not already in place. Americans do that. That's been something discussed here. You know, more generally, there's a big debate about whether America and Germany should have this transatlantic trade and investment partnership. And the Germans saying, oh, the Americans, they put chlorine in their chickens and things like that. They do not trust our consumer protection, our safety standards. And here's an incident where they have to take one back and say, oh, my goodness, why didn't we do that before? It seems so self-evident now.
Andrew Dennison at Transatlantic Networks in Kunzwinter, Germany. Thank you very much for joining us, Andrew.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about flying and pilots, pilot mental health, after the horror in the French Alps, where the co-pilot, by all signs, brought the plane down, slammed it into a mountainside, killing all 150 aboard, himself, Andreas Lubitz included. On Thursday, the French prosecutor, Brice Robin, described what had been learned from the plane's black box, interpreted here by The Guardian, picking up here where the pilot was locked out of the cockpit.
Alone at the controls of this Airbus A320, the co-pilot manipulates the buttons of the flight monitoring system to affect the descent of the aircraft. The act of selecting the altitude can only be deliberate.
Deliberate, and down it came. Here's the CEO of Lufthansa, parent company of German Wings, Carsten Spohr, acknowledging that Lubitz had returned to pilot training. He was deemed psychologically and physically fit to fly.
And after that, he was successful in all of the medical checks, the psychological tests. He went through all of that with flying colors.
And here the CEO talking with CNN on Thursday, describing the system in place at Lufthansa to alert higher-ups of concerns. He said the airline is proud of its system, but this crash demonstrates it's fallible.
We have at Lufthansa a reporting system where crew can report without being punished their own problems, or they can report about problems of others without any kind of punishment. That hasn't been used either in this case. So all the safety nets we are so proud of here have not worked in this case.
Let's dig on into what may have happened here and what might be done to prevent this. With us now from Hamburg, Germany, is Heinrich Großbongart. He's an aviation expert, managing director at Expertise, an aviation industry consultancy based in Hamburg. Heinrich Großbongart, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Columbia, South Carolina, is Dr. William Edwin Green III, a psychiatrist in private practice, does psychiatric evaluations for the FAA and for airlines of pilots and air traffic controllers. He's also a professor of neuropsychiatry, behavioral health at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine, Columbia, South Carolina. Dr. Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
There is a lot that's been said by the prosecutors here who are examining the evidence, both the black box and on the ground. There is a huge cloud of speculation around this, I guess, as well. From what you are hearing so far, are you persuaded from afar, Dr. Green, that this was indeed the act of a co-pilot due to a troubled mind?
Well, first off, I want to express my condolences to all the family and friends that were affected by this, and that they are all in our thoughts and prayers over here in America. And secondly, it's pure speculation at this point in time. From what little bit we do know of the news, it does raise suspicions that the co-pilot may have had some kind of issues going on that unfortunately did not get recognized until too late.
I mean, as a psychiatrist, are you still really and truly thinking may have had some kind of issues?
Well, I have to say may in the sense that everything that we're hearing is speculation on the news, and there may be some inaccurate reports and things like that. And so I'm kind of reserving judgment. I do know that at least in the U.S. Right now, I feel very comfortable with the systems that we have already set up. I'm sure that right now in Washington, as well as Oklahoma City, in the FAA offices, they are pouring through all this information, looking to make sure that we have everything in place. But I feel very safe flying in the U.S. right now with our systems. There are multiple redundancies. And this would have been an extremely difficult, almost impossible thing to pull off in the U.S. with our current systems.
I want to look at those American systems. Let's okay. keep it in Europe for a second here. Heinrich Grossbongart there in Hamburg, Germany. What changes? We've just heard that Germany and other countries are now requiring two in the cockpit at all time. What other changes might we see in airline procedures or equipment, Heinrich, in the wake of this terrible crash?
First, let me point out, we don't know much at the moment. The assumption that the pilot caused this crash is, at the moment, the most plausible one. But finally, we will find out, have a conclusion at the end of the investigation report a year from now, probably. And that will be the time when really to discuss what changes have to be made, if any. First thing which has been done is, of course, that European Airlines adopted the rule to have two persons in the cockpit at any time. But if you look at it, it wouldn't really prevent someone who is determined to crash an airplane from doing so. It is a sort of a quick fix, which is sort of a appeasement for the flying public. But today we heard criticism from Air France, for example, and there are good reasons to say, we need to have a look. What procedures do we have? Do we need to make this change in the aircraft when a flight attendant took the seat of the captain, for example? How can we make this safe? So there will be a lot of discussion going on, and this discussion, of course, will include the selection process of pilots.
Could we just pause for one moment, Mr. Grossbongart, on the rule of two in the cockpit? What's the weakness in that two in the cockpit requirement? You say there's no assurance with it.
Imagine you have, at the moment, when the pilot, one of the pilots changes his seat, you have someone standing in the cockpit who is not strapped to his seat. Any turbulence or any violent rudder movement, rudder input, would simply make him fall from his feet. So he would lose control, and that would cause different dangers in the cockpit. So if I would be on the control of an Airbus A320, I can prevent anybody from standing up, from getting a firm stand, simply by pulling G forces, simply by putting the aircraft in a
tailspin,
a narrow turn.
Dr. Green in South Carolina, you know, what about it? I assume that the two-person in the cockpit rule in the States, I always thought that was about heart attacks or something, not setting up a wrestling match between those two over control of the plane.
Well, and I suspect it really was set up for both reasons. Primarily one of the main concerns would be if some type of catastrophic sudden medical event occurred and you had a lone pilot in the cockpit and the door closed, if you have a second air crew in there, theoretically you can maintain control of the cockpit and the airplane. In a situation like this, theoretically, even with two people in there, if someone was bound and determined, they could somehow disable the other flight deck officer and potentially crash the plane. That is actually one theory on what happened with a crash. I believe it was an Egyptian airliner. There are no foolproof 100% ways to prevent things like this, and that's the unfortunate truth. But again, I do believe that at least the systems that I'm aware of in the U.S. that the FAA has set up are about as close as you can come to foolproof.
Heinrich Grossmungart, in Germany, what about the door? Could we talk about that for a second? The doors have been dramatically reinforced, strengthened, hardened since the 9/11 terrorist attack. But here we have a circumstance where the captain, having left the cockpit, could not get back in. Is there some engineering change in the door that this whole incident suggests might be wise?
We will see a change in the door area. Perhaps the change from the keypad you are using now to get access to, for example, the introduction of some biometric technology to definitely identify the person standing in front of the door. So the captain standing outside or the other crew member standing outside could always override the locking mechanism.
But I'm sure people, their imaginations get busy on that scenario. You can imagine some, let's say, terrorist forcing the captain to use the biometric override to open that door when that would not be wise.
Sure, but we have to see that the captain only leaves the cockpit for a short time, especially on when you have a two-man cockpit. He's only allowed to leave the cockpit for a short time to use the lavatory, and then he's to get back immediately. So this is something which is not predictable. Don't know when it will happen. You don't know. It is not a regular occurrence where you can plan for as a terrorist. So the risk on that at that point is, I think, very minimal.
Let me bring our callers in. There's much more we want to learn. They have questions and comments. Jesse in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Jesse, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I just had a quick comment. If I'm thinking this through right, I was imagining a team of people, say, that could remotely monitor and possibly control, say, for like the door. If something happens, a team of people so that you could have a better security measure, having multiple people who can monitor multiple planes.
Where would this team be, Jesse? Where would this team be?
I would think on the ground, maybe a whole new location, a whole new set of jobs for the FAA to have a security branch that, that only monitors, that can unlock doors from the ground. Of course, I think you would need multiple people so that you couldn't have one crazy get in there and make something happen. But, you know, something like that, possibly.
That's very interesting. Heinrich Grossbongard, what about it? Many people have, over time, thought they'd happier to have a pilot than everything on autopilot. But Jesse's saying, what about... you know, a team on the ground monitoring if something really strange is happening, it would override, maybe even automatically override. Autopilot would take over. I've heard many people say, bring on the robots in this case.
Yeah, but first thing is the faults, the accidents caused by malfunctioning of electronics, of computers on board, have been more frequent than the accidents by suicide we have seen. The problem is always to fully understand the situation on board, what is going on. The guys on the ground would need to have a very detailed picture. They have to have audio, they have to have full video coverage, they would have to have a full understanding of what's going on in the cockpit, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not easy to make that happen and to avoid mistakes being made there inadvertently.
But surely, I mean, when people get onto a passenger airliner, the main thing they want is to arrive at the destination. If the ground control could take over and prevent the airline from flying off of its course in the absence of some terrible weather, which they could see, and just bring it down on the runway. That sounds better than most alternatives one can imagine.
But we are flying drones around the world.
Yeah.
But these are relatively easy operations compared to the very complex, very dynamic environment an airliner is operating in, and compared to the technology of an airliner, if you simply think that the flight data recorder registers 1,200 data streams, and that's just a small portion of what's going on in the airline, in the aircraft and its system. So I'm very skeptical that it is really possible to understand what's going on. And at the end of the day, of course, you would need pilots on the ground, just as drones are flying by pilots as well, and not by air traffic controllers.
Dr. Green, do you think the ultimate answer here is in psychological observation? Is it in equipment? Is it in autopilot and processes?
Well, I actually ultimately think that we need to be careful about making especially any changes in haste. You know, when this previous caller had raised this question, the first thing that went through my mind was, God forbid, if we do set up a system like that and then a terrorist group is successfully able to hack that system, they could theoretically send planes all over the country into the ground. And then, you know, we could have a disaster worse than 9/11 with something like that. I mean, it's the law of unintended consequences. I think that clearly there are going to be a lot of rethinking about the way we treat psychiatric issues that may come up in pilots. Pilots are human, and so we have to realize that they are subject to, you know, episodes of depression and stressors in life, just like all of us are.
Dr. Green, hold that thought. We have to take a short break. I want to come back. That's your expertise, and I want to really dig in there, if we may. Dr. Edwin Wynn Green is with us from Columbia, South Carolina. Psychiatrist, does a lot of work with the FAA, traffic controllers, pilots. Heinrich Grossbongard is with us from Hamburg, Germany, consultant to the aviation industry there. Of course, two internationally known opera singers on that flight that went down in the French Alps. Here's Maria Radner. She was headed home from a performance in Barcelona. Here she is singing in that final production. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Us next to me. Und fragst du,
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Sound of church bells there in Montabaur, the hometown of co-pilot Andreas Lubitz, over the weekend, remembering victims of the German Wings airliner that he apparently brought down in the French Alps. All on board, himself included, a total of 150 lives lost in that crash. We're looking in this hour at flying and pilots, pilot mental health, after the horror of that terrible destruction and loss of life, and what might be done about it, whether there's a fail-safe possibility here. Dr. Wynne Green joins us from Columbia, South Carolina, psychiatrist who's done a lot of work with psychiatric evaluations for the FAA, the airlines, of pilots, traffic controllers. From Hamburg, Germany, Heinrich Grossbongart joins us, managing director at Expertise. It's an aviation consulting firm there. In a press conference in Berlin on Thursday, here was the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, saying the idea of intentionally crashing the plane, a pilot bringing it down, had been unimaginable.
German authorities report that we have to assume that this aircraft was deliberately activated for a crash. This is hard to comprehend for most people. Nobody can imagine this.
Nobody can imagine, but there will be changes, no doubt. Here's Irene Hufnagel. This is one of the doctors who performs mandatory yearly medical checks on German pilots. She says that the tests are quite limited and rely too much, she says, on patients' willingness to disclose problems. Here she is Thursday, interpreted by NPR.
The tests are flawed insofar that we only see the patient for an hour or so, and we have to rely on what they tell us about any psychological issues or whether they're taking antidepressants.
There's a question. Lots of listeners lined up here. Radia in Austin, Texas. Thank you for calling, Radia. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. I'm just wondering why nobody's talking about the elephant in the room, which is the fact that this man was on a psychotropic drug. We get this, we see this all the time with Columbine and all of the school shootings in the past, where they've been on a psychotropic drug, and the media just sort of skirts that out of the way. We know that the side effects of psychotropic drugs is suicide and homicide. And the FAA recently just changed the law. They used to not allow pilots, and I'm standing next to my best friend, Captain Peter McCarthy, who is he's a retired captain for Southwest Airlines.
Yes.
And we're both just kind of scratching our heads. Why is the media ignoring this issue?
Roddy, let us pick it up right here. We just heard the German doctor refer to it, but stick with us. Let me take it up with Dr. Wynne Green. What about psychotropic or antidepressants here? We have heard over the years that some can have dire side effects in some cases. What about in this case? What do you know, Dr. Green? And what are the rules in the United States on antidepressants and pilots?
Well, the rules on antidepressants and pilots are very strict here in the U.S. Basically, as the caller mentioned, this was actually approved several years ago. The FAA came out with a very tightly monitored system, and this was after recognizing that pilots do have episodes of depression, and there are only four medications that are approved. But basically, if a pilot is diagnosed with an episode of depression or anxiety issues that are severe enough to require medication, mm-hmm. such as an antidepressant, they are ineligible to fly. They are medically disqualified. And they have to then be evaluated by a psychiatrist trained specifically by the FAA. And they have to then, if they are started on antidepressant medication, they have to be in full remission from the episode of depression or anxiety for a minimum of 6 months before they are then eligible to be reconsidered. And there's a long process. Typically, when I'm seeing a pilot for the initial evaluation on what's called the SSRI protocol, usually I'm going to spend 3 hours with this person, and we're going to review every single document. It's quite involved and winds up being, you know, 10, 15-page dictated note. They also will undergo a full day-long battery of neuropsychological testing.
Dr. Green, I want to be sure I understand. So you're saying that if a pilot is determined to need an antidepressant, they are automatically come out of the cockpit? They're not flying for at least 6 months?
They are not flying. They are ineligible to fly in any capacity, whether as a commercial pilot or as a private pilot.
Are they compensated during that 6 months?
That is an issue. It depends upon, obviously, the airline, a commercial airline. A lot of the pilots will have short-term and long-term disability. And that is actually one of the reasons why the FAA eventually recognized that we need to have a pathway to treat pilots, was that they recognized that pilots were, if you will, hiding, unquote, their illness and were going out and getting treatment, not reporting it, which is a felony, and trying to fly. And so the FAA ultimately recognized that they needed to do this. And so they set up this pathway. It's extremely tightly regulated, and some would even argue almost too restrictive. I'm not necessarily in that group, but some would argue that. But basically, once the pilot is started on an antidepressant, they're going to be observed. Typically, it winds up being close to probably 9 months before they become eligible for issuance of a medical certificate. And this is even for a private third-class pilot. So you will not find a pilot legally flying in the U.S. on an antidepressant that has just started an antidepressant.
Dr. Usually, Green, is there a requirement of medical professionals in the United States, if they're treating, let's say, a commercial airline pilot, do they have a duty to warn if they see a problem there, to warn the FAA or the airline company? Is there any such thing?
I want to clarify, I'm not an attorney, thank God. But
you are a doctor who treats pilots, so you would presumably know if this were a legal requirement.
There would theoretically be a duty to warn if someone is being treated and has not reported this. There would theoretically be a duty to warn the FAA about that. And, of course, if the FAA were to hear that, they would immediately have their medical certificates denied.
Heinrich Gronsbongart in Hamburg, what about in Germany when it comes to antidepressant use? What about the case of Andreas Lubitz? And then privacy and the medical duty to warn Lufthansa or German wings if something was seen?
The situation, the legal situation in Germany is about the same. As soon as you as a pilot, private pilot or commercial airline pilot, get any information that you are unfit to fly because of medical conditions or psychological conditions, etc., you are not allowed to fly, and flying is a felony. The problem is, of course, that it is not very difficult to hide these things towards the authorities or towards your airline. If you don't want to discover it, you probably will be able to do so, as we have seen. A doctor who may not know that you are a commercial pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So he has not the information. And on the other hand, of course, confidentiality with respect to medical information in Germany is extremely strict. But the first problem is you need the pilot, you need a patient to come forward with the information. When he tries to hide it recklessly, it's very, very difficult to find out.
Let me go to Julie in Austin, Texas. Julie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm listening to this conversation and really I'm hearing them talk about pilots hiding illness, and I think that the conversation is increasing stigma and the misunderstanding and misconception surrounding mental health issues. Depression and suicidal tendencies don't make you homicidal and want to take down an airplane full of people. Mm-hmm. So why aren't we talking about better health care, better treatment, better follow-up, increased understanding of mental health challenges, rather than increasing the stigma and talking about more psychiatric screenings? Screenings aren't going to be the answer. It's got to be better care.
I mean, I think we're open to all of that. It's just that 150 people are dead, and people are trying to figure out why and what might be done. Dr. Green, how do you respond to that?
Well, and I think Julie brings up an excellent point, which is actually that if there was a complete ban on flying on antidepressants, basically what happens is that people that have had episodes of depression and are on antidepressants would be driven underground. And they'd either be trying to hide it and all that. And I would argue the system would be potentially more open to unsafe situations for pilots. And I think that is actually what ultimately was one of the factors that led to the FAA approving this policy change. A lot of physicians in America had been pushing for this change at the National Transportation Safety Board for many years.
Allowing American pilots after observation to be on these four antidepressants.
Right. Exactly. And when this rule first came out, it was extremely regimented and very hard to get approved. And actually what has happened is the FAA has found out that it has worked so well that they've gradually, very slowly, relaxed some of the requirements. It used to be that you had to be out of flying for more than a year. You had to be fully in remission from your episode of depression for a minimum of 12 months before you could be considered for the reentry process. Now that has been shortened to 6 months. They have specific tests that have been developed by neuropsychologists that test the memory and attention. And the joke among the pilots is that if I'd been given this test when I first started flying, they wouldn't have approved me. This test is much more difficult than the tests that typical pilots go through when they're hired at airlines. And so I feel very comfortable with the system that we have in place now. And kind of the joke is whenever I get on a plane and I recognize one of the pilots that I have in monitoring, I feel very comfortable because I know that person is solid as a rock.
Of course, it deserves pointing out that Lufthansa thought the same until they didn't. And we've heard that shock in the voices of the CEO of Lufthansa, the voice there, and German Wings. Heinrich Grossbaumgart, in Hamburg, we heard the CEO of Lufthansa said that there was no system in the world that could have predicted and prevented Andreas Lubitz's actions. He said he was 100% fit to fly. There was no particular thing to note or to watch out for in him. Does that stand up to scrutiny, Heinrich? Does that appear to be true?
We don't know better up to now. But what I know as a fact is that Lufthansa, within its entire group, have created a really trust-based atmosphere which encourages any pilot to come forward with problems, be it mental problems, be it ordinary medical problems, or be it drug problems.
But that seems to have failed utterly in this case.
Excuse me?
That seems to have failed entirely in this case.
As I said before, mm-hmm. if you have someone who really hides critical information, mm-hmm. and we all know people who we hear of who have, for example, depression or whatever, or,
sure.
or some mental illness,
mm-hmm.
you would never expect them to have it. It's even in ordinary life, it comes it very often comes as a surprise. Of course, there will be a lot of soul searching going on within Lufthansa in the next month. Of course, everything will be put into question. Everything will be reevaluated as soon as we have the necessary information. At the moment, and that's what I want to remember you, is we are just less than 1 week after this tragic event. So and we don't have lots of really hard facts at the moment.
I'm still getting so many comments from listeners online here saying, what about an override? What about an override? If a plane goes into a sharp descent like this, was obviously not in any correct flight plan, is there no way we could have monitoring and an override for the ground, from the ground? You say, Heinrich, that just isn't in the cards.
Any override from the ground. Imagine you have, there are lots of reasons why aircraft suddenly have to deviate
yes.
from their flight path. For example, to deal with any technical problems or to deal with to escape any dangers. So that is something where the guys on the ground are far too far away to take any good action and to be of any help.
But in this case, wouldn't this angle of descent be outside of any reasonable, you know, evasive maneuver of weather or technical problem? Wouldn't it be recognizable as a crash trajectory?
No, not at all. Not at all. This descent we have seen, at least for the first from 38,000 to 10,000 feet, could have easily be explained by an emergency descent because of a pressure loss in the cabin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Would have been perfectly normal.
Wow. That puts it back in your wheelhouse, Dr. Green. The pilots, they have to be in good mental health, taken good care of, and have some transparency with the airline.
That is correct.
Well, we wish you good luck with that. We hope that your screening goes well, that treatment goes well. Difficult times come to everybody. With pilots, the number of lives they carry in their hands is so large. We need them on the beam and just as in as good a shape as they can be. Good luck with that, Dr. Green. Please help us make it happen.
That's what I'm trying. Thank you.
And Heinrich Grossbungart in Hamburg, Germany. All of our sympathies go out to all the families that have suffered here. We thank you for your insights today in joining us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Heinrich Grossbungart with expertise in Hamburg, Germany. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.